we'll turn our attention on a football theme, something a little bit different. And we got a massive reaction last week to our chat with historian Mark Duncan. And we marked the anniversary of the overturning of the GAA ban. It was 50 years on from that. And we're going to look at another fascinating anniversary this afternoon, because 100 years ago, a chain of events was set in motion that led to the division of Irish soccer north and south of the border. Now, I'm going to be really honest with you and admit I knew very little about this particular topic until I started doing a little bit of digging myself. And if you're like me, then some of this detail is going to really surprise you, maybe even shock you. Historian and author Cormac Moore is going to join me very shortly. And Cormac has written a book on this subject and he knows more about it than most. But before we talk to Cormac, here's a little flavour of what happened back from an RT documentary which aired on this particular subject a couple of years ago.
I honestly believe that there was a huge amount of naivety surrounded the playing of the game 48 hours after all those people lost their lives.
We used to have one football team that represented the whole island, just like in rugby. But even before the country divided, football did.
I mean, we were all glad that the game was played and played in Belfast. I think everybody felt that sport should win and football should win over the Troubles.
There was parties in the Falls Road, the Shankill Road, all the different parts of Belfast celebrating. Everybody was celebrating down in Dublin. We thought we've unified the country.
The team was called Shamrock Rovers 11. Because the IFA were against it, and even my old pal Liam Toohey would have told me that the FAI weren't too enamoured by the whole thing either, because they weren't running the show.
It is a really good experience now, watching Northern Ireland play football. And there's one slight issue still left to go, and that is the anthem. Why can't we get our own anthem?
No matter where you go, nothing brings a halt to you like standing for national anthem. Suddenly, you've got the country dependent on you.
I didn't even know any Protestants, because I grew up in West Belfast and went to a Catholic school, and you never got the opportunity. But then when I started playing football, when I was 16, 17, you started playing different teams and different teams from other schools.
It's almost 100 years since football fractured. Can that split be healed? Can football in Ireland overcome a century of division?
Well, I'm delighted to say we are joined by Cormac Moore, author and historian. Cormac, thanks for joining us here on Sunday Sport. And given the history and the politics of the situation north of the border, it may surprise many and it might even shock them to hear that the split in Irish soccer didn't come about as a result of partition. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, the primary reason for the split was actually internal politics and not the political partition of Ireland. Now, and I have argued that the political partition didn't help matters, and it certainly heightened tensions. But there's a huge gap between how Dublin and Leinster felt they were treated by Belfast, and that ultimately had been, you know, that this kind of split had been building up, and this division had been building up over years, decades even, where people from Dublin and Leinster felt there was a Belfast bias. So if the split didn't happen in 1921, it probably would have happened afterwards, not because of political partition, but because of a perceived Belfast bias. So that is the primary reason for the split in Irish football.
Sure. So sporting politics alive and well 100 years ago. Yeah. Cormac, can you tell me about the national team before that divide? What would have been the makeup of the squad? I'm not sure what competitions they would have been competing in, but how would you rank that team, those squads, before that break?
So the Irish Football Association was founded in 1880. It had its first international in 1882. Not a very successful occasion, I'm afraid. England came to Belfast, where they played an Irish team mainly from Belfast-based clubs and the surrounding areas, and they trashed them 13-0. So it still is Ireland's either north or south's heaviest defeat. And from there on in, in 1884, the British Home Championship was inaugurated, and that was an annual tournament where England, Scotland, Wales and Ireland competed against each other. Unfortunately, Ireland didn't fare very well for years. They used to beat Wales occasionally, but generally didn't, and they always pretty much lost to England and Scotland until the 1900s. The makeup of the team was primarily from Ulster-based clubs, so the likes of Linfield, Distillery, Glentoran, Glenavon and so on. Belfast Celtic would have had quite a few players as well. And then you would have some small pickings from the Dublin teams, Shelburne and Bohemians. The IFA wouldn't allow players who played for overseas clubs in England and Scotland until 1899. And from there on in, you see a lot more players being selected who were playing overseas. But the one common denominator when the Irish soccer was unified was that very few players were selected from Dublin-based clubs. Even when Dublin-based clubs like Shells, like Bowls, started to win the Irish Cup, which was the blue-ribboned competition, they still wasn't commensurate with their success, the amount of players selected from those clubs.
And was it that? Was it the slow build-up, or was there one particular moment that pushed it over the edge that caused this and would lead to the divide?
Well, there was a catalyst. It certainly was building up. The catalyst happened in March 1921, so just over 100 years ago. Shelburne, who had won the previous year's Irish Cup, they were in the semi-final against a Lurgan-based team, Glenavon. And the Protest and Appeals Committee of the IFA in January of that year decided that because of the prevailing conditions in Dublin, because of the War of Independence, it was too unsafe for teams from Belfast to travel to Dublin. So they decided that all the semi-final, final of the Irish Cup would be held in Dublin. Now that was kind of ignoring the more wide-scale and more sectarian and civilian-based nature of the violence in Belfast. But that was the ruling. So Shelburne went to Belfast for the first the semi-final against Glenavon. That was a draw. They automatically assumed the replay would be in Dublin, as normally was the case. But the IFA ruled they had to come back to Belfast. They refused to do so. Leinster backed them. And ultimately, that was the reason why they decided to leave the IFA and in subsequent months formed the FAI.
So in terms of the divide in the early days of it, I'm sure there was an awful lot of stuff that had to be ironed out. But wasn't there a situation where there were two teams competing as Ireland? And you had a situation where you had some players representing both Irelands. And the irony of that, I don't think, would be lost on too many people at home. But how was that the case?
Yes, so first of all, the FAI had difficulty in gaining international recognition. It got international recognition from FIFA in 1923, but it had more difficulty in the British associations, particularly the English FA. The English FA was probably, and I know you were talking earlier just about the UEFA breakaway tournament, but at that time, FIFA wasn't this all-powerful, all-strong body. The FA was probably a stronger body at that stage. So the fact that the FA or the other British associations, which were the oldest associations, they didn't recognise the FAI until 1923, late 1923, but they wouldn't play them. They just refused to play two Irish teams. And so the Irish team selected by the IFA was the one that played the British Home Championships for years. And it actually shows that this wasn't based on political partition, because the IFA never recognised themselves as the governing body for the six counties. They believed they were the governing body for the whole 32 counties and remained to selecting players from all parts of Ireland up until 1950. The FAI wanted, both actually wanted an All-Ireland team. They had a number of conferences attempting to get that up until 1932, but they did then move away from that kind of those potential opportunities to reunite. And started to select players a lot more frequently from the 30s onwards, particularly the IFA. The FAI did it as well. It was particularly the case that the IFA would select anyone born in Ireland playing for them. And you had one very strange weekend in 1946. On the weekend, you had an Irish team, an IFA Irish team, playing against England, with Jackie Carey playing for that team. And then a few days later, the English team came to Dublin to play an FAI-selected Irish team, and Jackie Carey played for them as well. So it was a kind of a bizarre scenario that went on for a number of decades, actually. And it was actually FIFA's ruling that once the British associations decided they would compete in the World Cup from 1950, that the Irish teams could not select players outside of their jurisdictions. And that's when the IFA stopped doing that, was 1950.
You've mentioned it there already about, you know, maybe trying to heal the rift. Did they ever come close to that, Cormac?
Oh, very, very close. There was two particular years, 1924 and 1932. You have to remember, the IFA was the fourth oldest association in the world. It was on the International Football Association board, still is on that. And, you know, had a lot of gravitas, great relationships with the other British associations. And it actually offered this renegade association, this new breakaway association, the FAI. It practically offered it on equal terms, you know, that they would... Most of the criticisms the FAI had were of not getting proper representation in the IFA Council, not having enough international matches in Dublin, not getting enough players selected on the Irish team. So the IFA in 1924 pretty much offered the FAI everything based on equality, so that they would reunify. But they insisted that the chairperson would remain the IFA president. And this initially, the FAI were taken off their feet. They, according to the press reports, they were absolutely flabbergasted and delighted with the terms the IFA offered them. But then when they went back to the other people in the FAI, they rejected the terms because of that decision on the chairperson. So those negotiations fell down. And then 1932, that was cleared up. And it looked like they're about to sign the papers to reunify. But then the FAI insisted that they wanted a seat on the International Football Association board. The IFA have two seats on that. And then the IFA decided to call it quits. And that was the last real attempt to unify. They actually did meet a lot during the Troubles as well, quite surprisingly, on 10 occasions. But they didn't come as close as they did in 24 and 32.
Sure. Now, I think we all have a sense of identity when it comes to sport, no matter where we come from. And how did the sense of identity fuel tensions then between the two regions and, I guess, the backdrop of partition and the violence which would come?
Yeah, it certainly was felt very much on a club level. You had Belfast Celtic, the nationalist-leaning club, who often was pitted in violent riots against some of the unionist-leaning clubs, Linfield, Glentoran. There were very violent occasions where hundreds were injured. You know, revolvers were being used. It actually led to Belfast Celtic leaving football altogether for 4 years, from 1920 to 1924. In terms of identity, many people within the IFA, the president, James Wilton, others like Thomas Moles, were unionists in outlooks, were unionists in politics. Well, I don't think it was very overt, though. They tried to steer clear from politics. But, you know, certainly when they made a decision, it seemed to favour unionist based clubs or leaning towards Protestantism. For example, most unionists and Protestants did not want to countenance Sunday football. So the IFA had a ruling that there could be no Sunday football. That was going on right up into the 50s. Even when they were in the 58 World Cup, there was doubts that they would play one of the fixtures, which was meant to be on a Sunday. But Catholic clubs or nationalist clubs had no problem with Sunday football. And the minute the FAI was formed, we had Sunday football in Dublin pretty much immediately. Identity was an issue. But then you have sports like boxing and horse racing, where you have people from multiple backgrounds, multiple identities, and they're united. So you can't explain the division on identity.
Cricket and hockey as well, rugby.
Well, they're, from a governance perspective, particularly at a time of partition, they were dominated generally by Protestants from upper classes of society. And so they didn't have the identity issues like soccer or athletics would have had. But like rugby certainly has had players from different backgrounds, but the actual administrators were mainly Protestants and mainly of unionist outlook. And in fact, the IRFU refused to fly the tricolour up until they were forced to in 1932 by the Free State government, whereas they had no problem in flying the Union Jack on Ravenhill in Belfast.
Mm. Maybe you could talk to us about the significance of the flag and the anthem as well. And I guess even today, they remain powerful symbols of what each team stands for. You know, how did the tricolour and Aran Avian become symbols of the Republic of Ireland teams?
Almost by accident, the Aran Avian did, because when the Irish Free State team started playing, there was no national anthem. Obviously, the Irish Free State was a fledgling state. Actually, the Irish soccer team was one of the first times where Ireland was represented as a an independent nation and flew the tricolour, but they didn't know what anthem to play. So they actually, frantically asked the government, what's the national anthem? And there was no national anthem up until the late 20s, early 30s, when Aran Avin was decided upon. So they were playing Let Erin Remember, they were playing other songs as well to fill that gap. It actually never came up as an issue between the IFA or the FAI because it never got that far. I think it certainly would have been an issue. There was, before the split, there was a tricolour incident in Paris at an amateur international in February 1921 where some of the fans were trying to get the team to walk behind a tricolour and the IFA had them thrown out of the ground. And that caused a lot of tension within Dublin. So it never actually came up at that time as an issue, but it certainly would come up if, you know, hopefully one day there will be an All-Ireland team in the future. If that ever was to happen, obviously you'd have to do something about flags and other emblems. As all other sports who are united, they have dealt with that very sensitively and have tried to cater for different identities, different cultures in accommodating the different traditions on the island.
Mm. Now, North and South did come together for a game. They weren't known as Republic or North or even Ireland. They wore, as far as I remember, the Shamrock Rovers kit as well, didn't they? What was a pretty significant game.
Yeah, it was against that great Brazil team who'd won their third World Cup only 3 years previously. The game in Lanzarote Road was in 73, just 3 years after Mexico 70. And it was a great game. Apparently, I've spoke to so many people who were at that game. It's a bit like the amount of relatives.
All Blacks and Munster.
Our ancestors in the GPO in 1916. You know, everyone seemed to have crammed into Lansdowne Road for it. Now, it wasn't organised or even supported by the IFA or the FAI for that matter. So it was actually called Shamrock Rovers 11. They did lose the game by one goal to Brazil. But what happened afterwards was the FAI then contacted the IFA after that game and actually said, would you be interested in meeting, maybe about amalgamating, maybe about having one international team? And as I said earlier, there was about 10 conferences in the 70s and up until 1980 to explore that option. Even Harry Cavan, who was president of the IFA, vice president of FIFA at the time, he was seen as the biggest obstacle. But he said it was nonsensical having two football teams on a small island like Ireland. So there was talks, and that's what gives me some hope, that the fact that they were able to talk during the height of the Troubles, you know, the 70s was the worst decade of the Troubles, and they still talked and they still had a number of conferences about having at least one international team. Maybe it'll happen in the future. We're a long way off, obviously, but it may happen in the future.
Yeah. As a kid growing up, I vaguely remember the 82 World Cup when Northern Ireland did so well. The 86 one was probably the one where I really zoned in on a Cormac.
Yeah.
And you know, both those World Cup teams, they did so well. Do you think it's fair to say that they inspired the Republic's success that would follow?
Yeah, no, I think, actually, I'm a bit like you, Darren. They were my first. I vaguely remember Gerry Armstrong scoring in 82, but I remember vividly, actually, my favourite World Cup still is the 86 World Cup, and I vividly remember 86 and the three games Northern Ireland were in. I think Ireland were going to succeed someday. I know Jack Charlton had a huge role in that, but there was so much talent in the Republic as well. You know, it's unlikely if Jack Charlton wasn't there that they wouldn't have qualified for a major tournament. There were so many great players playing for the best teams in the English First Division. So I'm sure it did. I'm sure it had spurred them on and it prompted them to success. But in many ways, the success of both the Northern Ireland and the Republic of teams subsequently didn't help chances of unity, because as Harry Cavan said, why do we need to unify? We're doing so well in these competitions.
Yeah, I would you believe it or not, I have the Panini sticker album from the 86 World Cup.
I don't
still
have it anymore, but I had it at the time.
I actually got all the stickers bar one. I was missing a Brazilian player who I can't remember, but it's still at home in my mum's house. But if you look at the names there, you know, you have the likes of Jennings, obviously,
of
Donaghy, MacDonald, McIlroy, Armstrong, and I was a big fan of Norman Whiteside. But you look at the great players there, and then you look at the great players in the Republic, and if you brought them all together, I always wonder what a great side we might have had back then.
Oh yeah, if you even look at the 70s, can you imagine the, you know,
best
best obviously coming to his end, but you know, there are so many great players for both teams. Martin O'Neill, you know, Duggan, Derek Duggan, you know, and then Liam Brady was coming to the fore as well. It would have been we could have had a really strong team in the 70s up until the 90s. We can only wonder what if would have happened.
Okay, and before we finish up, reunification, can the split be healed? I'm thinking you're quite positive about this from what you've been saying already.
No, I'm not really. No, I think it will happen potentially, eventually, but
maybe not in our lifetime.
Maybe not in our lifetime. It should happen for logical and common sense reasons. It should happen, but when it comes to Irish footballing, governing decisions, logic and common sense don't necessarily come into the equation. I think that what will help is the fact that we're never going to have the players or have the status in, say, the English Premier League. The English Premier League now is a global brand. When Ireland had successful teams was when the Irish or the English First Division was mainly, you know, England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales. And that's why we had so many great players playing for the best teams in England. That is just unlikely to happen in the future. And we also have to remember, we might qualify for European competitions because so many countries are allowed into that competition. But the World Cup is going to become more difficult because it's going to have to become more democratic in selecting African and Asian countries. So there's going to be less European qualification places. And that means the chances of either Northern Ireland or Republic of Ireland qualifying for the World Cup is going to be very remote going forward. So that might give some hope that they might actually go, look, if we want to qualify for the World Cup, we're going to have to come together. There's no sign of it happening. It may not happen, but it could happen. And the fact, as I said, they talked when the troubles were at their most bitter would suggest it can happen again.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Do you know that, Cormac? Really fair point. And given the situation both countries are at the moment, we're not exactly shooting the lights out. Maybe it might force a hand. Thanks a million. Really enjoyed the chat. And we'll say goodbye to Cormac Moore. But he is the author of The Irish Soccer Split. It's published by Cork University Press, published actually back in 2015. But the guys have republished it in paperback edition for the centenary in 2021.